Even at an early age, Craig Price's life was filled with nothing but violence. At the age of 9, he started having disturbing thoughts about death and murder. He then joined a gang of juvenile delinquents and built up a rap sheet with charges of breaking and entering, robbery, stalking, drug use, and assault. On July 27, 1987, at the age of 13, he broke into the home of Rebecca Spencer and started down a path of infamy, making him the youngest serial killer in U.S. history. Welcome to History's Biggest Villains. Craig Price was born on October 11, 1973 in Warwick, Rhode Island. He lived with his siblings while his father, John, worked at the local Kmart department store in a management position, and his mother, Shirley, was a clerical worker at the same store. Many people around his neighborhood regarded Craig as a good kid. He would help others by carrying their groceries or mowing lawns. He had good grades in school and played football and basketball, as by the time he was 13, he stood 5'10" and weighed 240 pounds. However, around this time, his mentality started to shift as he joined a gang of juvenile delinquents who went around burglarizing homes in the neighborhood. He built up an extensive rap sheet with charges of breaking and entering, robbery, stalking, drug use, and assault. He also began to experiment with weed and LSD. One of the nights he was out roaming around the neighborhood and lurking in the shadows, he found himself outside the home of a neighbor, Rebecca Spencer, who lived just 2 houses down from where Craig lived. Rebecca rented the home and was living there with her brother and 2 children, her 8-year-old son and 4-year-old daughter. Rebecca's lease was due to expire at the end of July 1987. For weeks, she had been preparing to move. However, with 2 young kids at home, this was difficult for her. She told her ex-husband that she needed an opportunity to pack without the children around to distract her. So he began taking the kids with him for whole days so that Rebecca could get the work done. The morning of July 27th, 1987, Rebecca's ex-husband picked up the children early. After they were gone, she enlisted the help of a friend, and the two spent the majority of the morning packing boxes. The two women worked throughout the entire day until 6 o'clock p.m. when Rebecca decided to cook some dinner for her friend and brother. Rebecca's brother worked nights, so he left the home around 8:30 p.m., and shortly after, her friend's boyfriend came over to help them pack up some more things. When it seemed that they had most of Rebecca's things sealed in moving boxes, the three of them left to go have ice cream and run a few errands. They returned to the house around 11 p.m., and her friends left for the night around midnight. After closing the door behind them on their way out, she went and changed into some pajamas before grabbing a blanket and lying down on the living room floor to watch a little bit of television. Then she fell asleep. When Craig snuck into her house that night, that's how he found her, asleep on the living room floor, curled up in the blanket. He went into the kitchen where he intended to grab a frying pan. Craig changed his mind when he saw a 10-inch kitchen knife lying on the counter as he walked by. When he returned to the living room, he stood over Rebecca for several minutes, just watching her as she slept. Suddenly, he bent down and proceeded to stab her violently. He brutally stabbed her and punctured her heart, liver, lungs, face, and head, a total of 58 times. When he was finished, he stood up and calmly left the house. He went out the back door, snuck over her back fence into her neighbor's yard before heading to his own home. Craig was only 13 years old at the time of this murder. It wouldn't be until the following day, when her brother returned home from work, that people would know anything about what happened to her. When her brother came in and saw her lying in a pool of blood, he quickly dialed 911. Despite knowing she was dead, he attempted to perform CPR until the police arrived. When the authorities got to the house, they established a perimeter. Then they set about looking for clues. They combed the property and found no evidence that would lead them to the killer. As a result of this lack of evidence and no further leads from people nearby, the case grew cold. Craig had gotten away with murder. 2 years later, Craig was a freshman in high school, but the urges to kill couldn't be controlled. Joan Heaton married Sergeant John Heaton when she was young, and it wouldn't be long before their family would grow. Their first daughter, Jennifer, was born in 1979. Then 2 short years later, they welcomed another daughter they named Melissa. On June 19th, 1983, John committed suicide. In 1985, Joan started a new life with her daughters in a new house in a new city. She decided on a new neighborhood as an ideal place to start over. On September 1st, 1989, Craig, who was now 15, decided to kill again. High off of weed and LSD, he broke into Joan's home and went to the kitchen. On the counter, he found a set of kitchen knives that Joan had purchased earlier that day. He then made some type of noise to wake her up, and when she went downstairs to investigate and saw the large teenager in the kitchen, she began to scream. In order to stop her screams, Craig lunged at her and wrapped his hands around her neck, strangling her until she became unconscious. He then took one of the knives and stabbed her 57 times. After hearing their mother's screams, Joan's daughters came down to check on her. Craig saw 10-year-old Jennifer first, So he grabbed her and started stabbing her right in front of her 7-year-old sister, Melissa. As she was being attacked, she shouted to her sister to call 911. Craig stabbed Jennifer 62 times, leaving the knife lodged inside her neck. He managed to grab Melissa before she got to the phone. He stabbed her 30 times, as he was so violent with this attack that the handle of the knife broke. He then bashed her in the head with a kitchen stool, crushing her skull. After the massacre, Craig covered two of the bodies with sheets and walked out the door. When Joan hadn't contacted her parents in 3 days, her family knew something was amiss, so they went to check on her. Upon arriving at the house, her mother Marie and sister Mary Lou saw the car parked in the driveway. Still, nobody answered the door when they knocked, so their concern grew even more. They walked around back to check things out. There, they found the back door unlocked, so they went inside to take a look around. As soon as they walked through the door, they saw blood everywhere. Not knowing what happened, the women turned to go down the hallway where they saw Joan's body covered with a sheet. They found Jennifer lying in a pool of blood a short distance away, and Melissa's body was alone in the kitchen. They called 911. The first person called in to help with the investigation was Dr. Henry Lee, the world-famous forensic scientist who specialized in blood analysis. When Dr. Lee went over the crime scene, he noticed a footprint in the blood. The print belonged to a men's size 13 sock. Since there wasn't anyone in the house that wore that size, authorities could determine that the killer left it himself. The second person that was called in was Special Agent Greg McCrary with the FBI. Agent McCrary was an FBI profiler, and he determined that the suspect showed sheer anger and rage while committing these murders. Knowing this, he told them that it was highly probable that the suspect cut himself with the same blade that broke off in Melissa's neck. In conclusion, he advised local authorities to look for anyone with bandages on their arm or hand. One day, a couple of officers were patrolling the area when they came across Craig hanging out with some friends at the park. They were well acquainted with him due to his previous run-ins with authorities. He was also a regular participant in local police-sponsored youth events. When the two officers saw him, they decided to ask him if he heard anything about what had happened in the neighborhood. They also noticed that one of his hands was bandaged, so they asked him what happened. He told them that he punched a car window when he was drunk. Why would you tell the police that you vandalized a car? That makes no sense. Okay. The police looked into previous reports to try to corroborate his story. They couldn't find any reports of vandalism or glass left on the street. They knew he was lying about his injury. His previous breaking and entering convictions raised alarm bells as well. Apparently, Craig had been bragging to one of his friends about killing Rebecca back in 1987 and getting away with it. So that friend went to the police with this information. Like, why? It's so dumb. As her murder was still unsolved, the police were able to secure a search warrant for Craig's home. In the early morning hours of September 17th, 1989, Warwick police raided the Price family home. They turned it upside down, looking for any physical evidence to link Craig to the murders. When he woke up to the police searching his parents' house, he crawled back into bed to go back to sleep. Just when the officers thought they were gonna leave empty-handed, one of them found something intriguing. He noticed there was a shed in the backyard that still hadn't been searched. Not long after entering the shed, they located a plastic bag that had been tucked underneath some objects. When they opened the bag, they found a collection of blood-soaked items that included knives, clothing, gloves, and other random things. They also found the bloody sock that made the footprint in the Heaton's home, so Craig was promptly arrested. After Craig was put in handcuffs and secured in the back of the squad car, the police asked his mother if she wanted to accompany them down to the station. She agreed to ride along, and the entire way there, all she could do was cry. Craig, on the other hand, seemed detached from the whole situation, acting as if he was just going for a Sunday drive. The police questioned why he was so angry all the time, and Craig said it was because of racism. He explained an incident where Rebecca's brother Carl cursed and shouted racial slurs at him and his friends one night. Craig swore to get revenge for this. Craig talked about how he spent the next couple of days watching Carl drive by on the street. He would watch the car every time it pulled in and out of the driveway at Rebecca's house. When Carl was questioned about this, he denied using racial slurs or even speaking to Craig at all. Eventually, Craig confessed to all his crimes. He said on the night of Rebecca's murder, he waited until his whole family was asleep before he snuck out of the house. He crept into his neighbor's yard, climbed a fence, and wound up in her yard, only to be disappointed when the car he was looking for wasn't parked in the driveway. When he didn't see the vehicle, he returned home and he smoked some weed. After he got high, he decided to sneak back over to the house and see if the car had come back. And even if it hadn't, he would break in and rob the place. You know, just super sound judgment right here. Upon returning to the yard, he noticed that the TV was on. A woman was lying on the floor, covered, by a blanket. At that moment, he convinced himself that he would go into the house and kill the woman while she slept. He then explained the murders at the Heaton home. He gave precise details how he had strangled Joan because she had walked in on him soon after entering the house. After Craig described strangling and stabbing Joan, he talked about killing her daughters. He went into vivid detail about the girl's screams of terror, their cries as they begged him to stop. When he was finally done talking, the detectives had more than enough information to charge him with 4 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of burglary. In 1989, justice systems weren't allowed to incarcerate juvenile offenders past their 21st birthday. Therefore, when Craig was found guilty on the murder charges, he was only sentenced to stay in the juvenile facility until he was 21. Craig knew this, and he even bragged that he would make history when he was released. The laws on young offenders in 1989 ensured that after Craig served his time, he would get released and his criminal record would be sealed. However, several infractions at the facility he was at caused him to be transferred to another facility where he refused to submit to any attempts health or prison officials made to engage him in the mandatory treatment and therapy. The public outrage over Craig's lenient sentencing as a violent offender due to his age was enough for people to demand legislation to prevent him from being released after 5 or 6 years. Jeffrey Pine, the assistant attorney general, and Kevin Collins, Warwick police detective, would join forces to help pass some new laws. The pair helped to pass the O'Neill Bill, which would harden sentencing guidelines for juvenile offenders. Unfortunately, their efforts would not be sufficient to keep Craig behind bars past his 21st birthday. Jeffrey Pine petitioned the Rhode Island courts to issue an order that would mandate Craig to undergo psychological testing and any pursuant therapy associated with those test results. Even with the court order, Craig refused to participate. His blatant refusal allowed Pine to file contempt of court charges against Craig in 1994. While Craig was in court facing contempt charges, he lashed out, threatening to kill a correctional officer. After this, he was found guilty of the contempt charges and sentenced to serve an additional 15 years with 8 suspended. Craig's violent behavior continued to escalate since he was incarcerated. In 1996, Craig received an additional year for biting the finger of an officer. In 1997, Craig was charged with contempt for again not complying with the therapy mandates ordered by the court. He was again found guilty, receiving an additional 25 years with 15 suspended. 1999 and 2001, Craig verbally and physically attacked prison officers and received 4 additional years added to his sentence. On July 29, 2009, Craig was involved in a prison fight with another inmate. While trying to break up the fight, one of the correctional officers was stabbed in the finger with a shank made by Price. In 2017, Craig attacked fellow inmate Joshua Davis with a shank and received 25 additional years for attempted murder. Before the incident in 2017, Craig Price's earliest parole hearing would have been February 2022. However, now that he received the additional 25 years, Craig might not ever see freedom again in his life, which is perfectly fine. Craig is currently incarcerated at Florida State Prison. I think when I first read this case, I was really shocked, like, how someone so young can have this much just murderous energy. Like, you're 13 years old and you want to murder someone, you want to kill someone. Like, and the thing is, he didn't just, it's overkill. Like, you're stabbing people 50 times, 30 times. Like, these people are dead already. Like, just overkill. I don't know what type of rage you had inside. I don't think it was the drugs. I think the drugs is just an excuse. Like, I think he just genuinely was an evil person. The fact that he could have got out, but he was just acting out. Like, he didn't even want to get out. If he didn't act out, he probably would have been free already. And he most likely, he would have killed some more people, if we're being honest. But if he didn't do all these prison, if he didn't have all these prison, like, instances, if he didn't get all these disciplinary things, he might have been out already. So, maybe he feels comfortable in the prison. That's what I'm thinking. Because most people are like, okay, I have a short sentence. Maybe if I sit here and relax and be quiet and just not make any trouble, I can get out and change my life. But it seems like he wants to be in prison. Like, he obviously doesn't want to get help. He doesn't want to get help. They keep trying to give him therapy, and he keeps denying the therapy. Well, I guess he'll stay in prison for the rest of his life anyway, because all these years added for the sentences, for all the prison infractions. Someone who murdered 4 people, including 2 little girls, would have been able to get out of jail at 21. If he was really on the straight and narrow, he could have got out. Like, that's insane. You kill 4 people, you're going to go over to a juvenile facility for 5 years. That's it? Like, listen, that's crazy. Thank you for watching. Leave a like if you enjoyed. That subscribe button if you're new to my channel. Please don't forget to turn on my post notifications if you haven't already. I appreciate all the support you guys give this channel. Leave a like, hit that subscribe button. I'm out. Peace.